This is an AMI podcast. This is an AMI podcast.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, May the 18th, 2022. Welcome to Now with Dave Brown, coming to you on AMI Audio and AMI TV. I'm Dave Brown. Let's hit the horns and go. Hello. Let's go. Coming up on the show today, writer, producer, director, Audrianne Bouchard describes Camille, the Story, a new theater production that offers a multi-sensory experience for audiences in Montreal. Veteran political correspondent Craig Oliver will talk about what's going on in the world of politics. We'll talk a little bit about the royals visiting Canada. We'll talk a little bit about the conservative leadership. We'll talk a little bit about the Ontario election. I think I'll have your accessibility story roundup with an interesting story about how a limited industry for complex rehabilitation technology, i.e. power wheelchairs, and the effect that limited industry is having on people with disabilities. And a new study shows a number of websites are collecting email and password data before you even hit the submit button. Oh me, oh my, oh me and I. Mike Agarbo will have the details when he joins us a little bit later in the show to talk technology. But I want to start the show with our top story of the day. Not typically a royal watcher over here, but there was some interesting sound that came from the opening ceremonies of Prince Charles and his wife Camilla making their way into Newfoundland and Labrador yesterday. Prince Charles started by offering up some praise for Canada's role on the world stage.
Time and again, you have shown your country to be a respected leader on the world stage, a much-needed voice in advocating for a greener and more sustainable future. And in an era where the global institutions of democracy look distressingly fragile, a model of determination and humanity.
Charles did offer some reflection on climate change and reconciliation.
However, as we look to our collective future, as one people sharing one planet, we must find new ways to come to terms with the darker and more difficult aspects of the past, acknowledging, reconciling, and striving to do better. It is a process that starts with listening.
Governor General Mary Simon says this trip will be a small step in the process of understanding the role of the monarchy in historical injustice and moving towards reconciliation.
And in this way, we will also promote reconciliation, which is not one act or project, nor does it have an end date. It's a lifelong commitment to learning about Indigenous communities and about their lives' lived realities.
Charles also discussed how the monarchy has been linked to so many moments in Canadian history.
On a subsequent visit in 1982, she is recalled signing the proclamation of the Constitution Act alongside Prime Minister, your father, Prime Minister Pierre Trudeau. At these defining moments and many others like them, the Queen was with you as Canada's history was written.
We'll talk a little bit more about this with Craig Oliver later in the show, but I want to move on to the inflation numbers that came out from Stats Canada just a couple of moments ago. Stats Canada releasing their inflation numbers for the month of April, 6.8% year-over-year inflation in the month of April. That's compared to 6.7% in March. So still seeing significantly higher numbers in regards to inflation. Let's jump to a different story that impacts the Russia-Ukraine conflict. Canada's foreign minister will be at the United Nations over the next few days to discuss the growing issue of international food insecurity caused by the conflict. Emily Jevesky looks ahead.
Melanie Joly will meet with UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres for talks and will take part in a United Nations Security Council open debate on the link between conflict and food security. Joly says Russia's actions in Ukraine are being felt across the world, especially among the most vulnerable countries. She says Canada, one of the world's biggest wheat exporters, is determined to work with its allies to help build future food security. Russia has blockaded Ukraine's ports, stopping exports of wheat and sunflower oil to countries that rely on them in the Middle East and Africa. Emily Jovesky, The Canadian Press.
And in another related story, NATO Secretary Jens Stoltenberg says Finland and Sweden have applied for membership amid concerns over Russia's war in Ukraine. Stoltenberg says regional security will be strengthened by the two Nordic countries joining NATO.
This is a good day at the critical moment for our security. Thank you so much for handing over the applications for Finland's and Sweden's membership in NATO. Every nation has the right to choose its own path. You have both made your choice after thorough democratic processes.
Stoltenberg confirmed the accession process should be quick, but notes some allies may raise a few concerns.
The security interests of all allies have to be taken into account. And we are determined to work through all issues and reach rapid conclusions.
The process usually takes about 8 to 12 months, but there is some speculation that may be expedited due to the crisis in Ukraine. And yesterday, we played some sound for you from Transport Minister Omar Al-Ghabra about lineups and delays at the airports. Well, the Canadian Airports Council is asking the federal government to do away with COVID-19 protocols at customs to clear up the chaos that international travelers have been experiencing when they arrive in Canada. Interim President Monette Pascher says the extra steps mean it's four times longer to process passengers who come through customs than it did before the COVID pandemic.
Getting back to regular travel with these health protocols and testing in place, the two can't coexist without a significant pressure and strain on our system.
She says Canadian customs is so backed up, there's not enough physical space to hold the lineups, so passengers are being held on planes for up to 75 minutes to let out folks in small groups. I'll say this, if I have to keep taking my belt off to get on a plane, maybe we can still check, you know, vaccine status and arrive can for folks to get off a plane. Just saying, it's been like 20 years since 9/11 and you're still making me take off my shoes. So, yeah, security, right? It's all about security until it's not about security. And then it's about convenience. Which one is it? We have to decide. That is not our daily poll, but it's a thought worth reflecting on. At AMI Audio is where you'll find us on Twitter. Accessible Media Inc. is where you find us on Facebook. Can you tell I didn't get a lot of sleep last night? Your boy was moderating that debate in Brantford, Ontario. And Brantford's far, man. Brantford's far. Yesterday, we asked you, how do you feel about politicians relying on notes at a debate? 30% of you said I'm fine with it, 40% of you said I don't like it, and 30% of you said I'm indifferent. At AMI Audio on Twitter, Accessible Media Inc. on Facebook. So I was talking to a couple of these students at W. Ross McDonald last night, and we were joking around about orientation and mobility. And one of the students, Alex, says to me, he says, gosh, I wish people everybody would get some orientation and mobility training, because there's all these public spaces when it's crowded that people just don't seem to know how to behave. So it got me thinking for the daily polls today. What kind of overcrowded place annoys you the most? Is it the store, like a grocery store, a pharmacy? Is it a restaurant? Is it public transit? Or I like crowds. You're a crowd person. You enjoy the crowds. I can't imagine who's going to vote I like crowds, but there's probably some folks out there who enjoy being packed shoulder to shoulder and waist to waist and toe to toe with the rest of the world. That is not me. I will tell you, a crowded grocery store, if there's ever some kind of media report that comes out about somebody having a total meltdown in public at a grocery store, that's going to be me. That's going to be me yelling at someone. It's not even about the arrows anymore. The arrows are generally gone, but like, we've been doing this grocery thing for a long time. These stores have existed. Some people just have really bad etiquette, just sort of leaving their cart wherever, going for a little wander, then like cutting you off and then uncutting you off and then giving you a look and then spending hours and hours in front of the margarine. Yeah, I know I should buy butter, but sometimes your boy needs margarine. Just saying. Sam, what's the overcrowded place that annoys you the most?
You know, I was thinking that it was going to be like restaurants, but I think that what you're identifying to is like, it's not so much the fact that it's overcrowded, but it's that people don't know how to behave when there are crowds too. And I think that is doubly so when you are talking about lines and queuing. Like, I think all of these places have an element of lining up in it that just seems to throw people for a runaround. And I think that in the case of getting in front of me and my food, yeah, it's annoying. But I think what makes me the most the most angriest was when it was happening to me in public transit.
Yeah.
Because usually, like, you can, you know, you don't get the benefit of being able to say, it's going to take me this long to get somewhere when you're taking public transit. There's a range.
I will get off a crowded bus or crowded subway. I'll be like, you know what? I'm going to wait for another one.
Yeah. And you're not too far from work. So I think that there's like, you can also get off and walk too.
I mean, I walk to work, period. Okay. I don't take the bus to work. I live close enough to walk. In fact, that was my entire purpose when I chose where to live, was to avoid public transit to get in the morning.
I just find that, like, especially when any of the public transit around Toronto gets shut down. Like, heaven forbid, you'll have to be on a shuttle bus somewhere, and you'll have to experience how terribly their contingency plans for the subways are. Because it's line up, crowds of people, and people rushing to get to places, because it's not that you're getting in front of people's food, you're getting in front of people's ability to make money to buy food, to go to work. You know, it's transit is, for me, very frustrating.
Yeah, I remember when I was skinny. Back in the day when I was actually in shape and skinny, I didn't mind being on a crowded bus because I didn't care if people were pressed against my body.
Sure.
I was like,
I'd go to the
gym. Now as a large and in charge gentleman, I do not like people pressing against my body.
You know? Reminding you.
Yeah, reminding me. Like, you take up a little more volume than you used to. Sam,
cheers.
Thank you for this. I appreciate your insights. Mike, what about you? I know you find yourself in some crowded places now and again. What are the crowded places that annoy you?
Every single one of them.
All of them. All of the above.
All of them. This is something. It's funny you asked this question because I think it was maybe about a week and a half ago. My wife and I were talking about the fact that she has been to both Disney's on both coasts of the U.S. and I was not able to go with her because when we were in California, I was working. So she spent the day at Disney while I worked. And then with Florida, she went down for spring break with her sister while I was working here. So again, work kept me away from it. And she said, but what do you care? You hate crowds. You hate going to these places. And then she asked me about Canada's Wonderland this year. And it was like, no, thank you. Any crowds, I can't stand it. And yet, I mean, I love sports, so you don't really have a choice, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this is not, you know, post-pandemic, pre-pandemic. This is all time.
Yeah.
I don't like lines, though I'm very patient with them. If I'm in a line, I am very patient, very polite, but I just don't like being in those situations.
Mm-hmm.
I don't expect to ever be the only guy at the ballpark. But sometimes, honestly, this is just how my mind is wired. I could sit there in a packed stadium and think, why do all these people have to be here when I want to be here?
Yeah, it's
this
true.
This sucks.
Why do you think I go to Thursday 3:07 first pitches?
There you go. There
That's
you
where
go.
I belong.
So I'm not a claustrophobic person. Crowds don't make me nervous. It's not that type of thing. I just don't like it. I've never been able to really put my thumb on it. But the fact is, when I am in those situations, I'm very polite about it.
Mm-hmm.
I can't stand rude behavior, right? But I also don't. I try really hard not to exhibit any of that behavior at all, but I don't like crowds.
What I like about the stadium experience is at least you have a seat. You have, in theory, a refuge from the people. And
if you're not seated in the most expensive seats at any arena where you're sandwiched in there, those are not comfortable places to be. That's no refuge. What I like, Dave, about the stadiums is that you can take, especially at Rogers Center, you can take a walk around the concourse and still be able to watch the game.
Yeah, take a stroll.
You can still see the game from the concourse. Brilliant.
Yeah, I did that at Fenway a couple years ago. Very enjoyable. Very enjoyable. Much more enjoyable than being crammed with the unwashed masses. Mike, thank you for this. We'll talk to you a little bit later in the hour for the big business story of the day.
All right, I'm going to go wash now.
At AMI Audio is where you find us on Twitter. Accessible Media Inc. is where you find us on Facebook. Sam Robinson can be found at the AMI Weather Desk.
Thanks, Dave. And here is your AMI National Weather Report from Environment Canada. Starting off as we do in St. John's, Newfoundland, it's cloudy this morning, rain beginning as well ending this afternoon, about 5 to 10 millimeters expected, the high 7 degrees. Moving to Halifax, a mix of sun and cloud this morning, the high 14 degrees. Up to Montreal, it's sunny this morning, the high 18 degrees. Over to Ottawa, sunny, the high 20 degrees today. Over to Toronto, it's sunny, but increasing cloudiness near noon, then a chance of showers late this afternoon, the high 15 degrees. Up to Thunder Bay, cloudy, showers beginning early this afternoon, and the high today 12 degrees. Moving to the prairies, in Winnipeg it's cloudy, a few showers beginning early this morning, ending this afternoon, and risk of a thunderstorm, the high 13 degrees. Over to Saskatoon, a mix of sun and cloud, 60% chance of showers early this morning, and the high 14 degrees. Over to Calgary, a mix of sun and cloud this morning, the high 13 degrees. Up to Edmonton, increasing cloudiness, 60% chance of showers late this afternoon, the high 13 degrees. Up to the territories, in Yellowknife, it's clearing this early this morning, the wind coming from the east at 30 kilometers, the high 12 degrees. In Vancouver, rain ending near noon, then cloudy, 60% chance of showers, the high 11 degrees. And finally, in Victoria, rain ending this morning, then a mix of sun and cloud with 40% chance of showers, wind gusts expected of up to 90 kilometers an hour, the high 14 degrees today. And that was your AMI National Weather Report from Environment Canada.
Windy day on Vancouver Island. Mm-hmm. Sam, thank you for this. Coming up next, writer, producer, director Audrianne Bouchard will describe Camille, the love story, or the story, a new theater production that offers a multi-sensory experience for audiences in Montreal. This is Now with Dave Brown on AMI. Welcome back. It's Now with Dave Brown on AMI. Performing art always presents the opportunity to have an experience. So many of your senses can be stimulated. In fact, the really great shows captivate you in many, many ways. Camille, the Story is an inclusive, immersive, multi-sensory experience that will be staged in Montreal starting next month. We've got a clip here of the audio trailer. Let's give that a listen.
I danced with no idea who, with people I didn't know, who didn't talk. It felt good. I catch my breath, rest my head in my hands. I wonder if you ever think of me. You're not here, but I feel like you are.
Audrianne Bouchard is the producer, director, and writer of Camille the Story, and she's here to tell you a bit more about it. Hey, good morning, Audrianne. Thank you so much for making time to be with us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So in what ways does the theater experience of Camille stimulate senses?
Yes. So the idea is that the idea at the beginning was to not use the sense of sight. And therefore, we thought, how can we communicate theater and dance? So text, movement, characters, scenography, set costumes, with the other senses. So the show is immersive. The spectator is invited to sit on stage at the center of the action. The performers are evolving all around them. And we use different smells. We use the sound of the body to communicate movement. We also interact with the audience members, giving them some objects that are meaningful to the story. So these are just some quick insights. I don't want to reveal too much, but that's the idea.
It's a really unique idea. How did you come up with it?
So I came up with it because I studied theater myself in Montreal at Concordia University, and I started working as a lighting designer in the field. But I have myself a visual disability. I have Stargardt's disease, so I only see with my peripheral vision. And it just occurred to me while I was working how visual the work that we do is in the performing arts. And I thought, how can we communicate what we do, dance and theater, beyond the visual relationship that prevails between audience and performers usually? So that started a whole research project. And we ended up creating Camille.
You presented the show in French a couple of years ago before the pandemic, but now it's being staged in English. How has the pandemic changed the way you present the show?
Yes. So at the beginning, there was a lot of physical contact involved in this show. It's a very small audience capacity. We have only 6 spectators at a time per show. And there was one performer per audience member guiding the spectator through the set, following the characters. Now, with the pandemic, we've had to reinvent the show a little bit. So the audience members are invited to stay seated in a chair. But there are also some special surprises happening in that chair. And we've kind of had to explore more smells and sound of the body rather than communicating movement through touch or playing with textures and things like that. So we still interact with some objects, like I said before, that we make sure that we disinfect, and you know, we still follow the sanitary measures, even if now things have loosened up a bit. But so we've had to kind of revisit and explore more the senses of smells and auditory, you know, possibilities of with the movement.
Audrianne, you mentioned you've got a extensive theater background, but what's it like for you as a creator to approach a unique style of show like this? What kind of challenge does that present? And do you like the challenge?
I love the challenge, absolutely. And at first it was a challenge for me and all the team because we're so used to make artistic choices based on what we see, you know, and we realized, okay, we have ourselves to work with our eyes closed or to wear a blindfold to be able to make artistic choices, not for their visual quality, but for the sound that this gesture will make or the smell that this ingredient will have when we cook it, or, you know, so it's a completely different way to look at our art. For example, the person who developed the set, it was quite a challenge for her to think, how can I create a space that people can be aware of, but that they will never get the chance to see? So it was a real challenge. And now I feel like, because I don't need my sight to work on this production, that it's very empowering for me as a person who has a visual impairment to be able to not have this challenge of using my sight and having to work hard to see everything. I can just let go of that and work with my eyes closed, and that's wonderful.
Along those lines, does working on a show like this potentially influence how you're going to create moving forward as you start moving away or moving into other kinds of shows? Are there lessons learned that you can pull from this experience that are going to influence how you make future art?
Well, hopefully. One thing is that we want to pursue this, developing this kind of creation with the team. So it's the same team. The Francophone team is also working on this Anglophone production, and we've already started developing a new show. And in terms of my work with more, I would say, standard theater companies, like, I think that, yes, it really allows me to think of how wider can we, you know, what are the other senses that could be triggered in a theatrical experience? And, you know, some people are reaching out to me because they want to approach the subject of the people living with visual impairments in their show, and they want the co-creators to have some sort of knowledge on how we can develop different forms of theater and dance shows.
Mm. When and where are the presentations of Camille going to be taking place?
Yes, so the shows are happening. The premiere is June 21st, and it runs for 2 weeks until July 3rd. It's going to be at the Siegel Center for the Performing Arts. And I have the phone number of the box office if you would like to call to reserve your tickets. It's already available at this moment.
Yeah, you can give us the phone number now, but what we'll also do is we'll share it on the blog after the show as well, ami.ca/now blog. But if you do have it handy, yeah, share that right now.
Perfect. It is 514-739-7944.
And there are some special promotions available for the blind and partially sighted community. What are they?
Yes, absolutely. So a regular price ticket is $30. And for people living with a low vision, we have a special price of $25. So please take advantage of that. Mm-hmm.
And just give us a reminder about where people can find more about tickets or the events or the show itself.
Absolutely. So we have our own website that is entirely accessible to people who have visual impairments. The address of the website is www.audeladuvisuel.com. And there is an English tab on the website where you can find all the information in English. You can listen to a short clip that will tell you all about what this experience is and what to expect.
Excellent. And we'll again make sure to share that information on the blog after the show at ami.ca/now blog. No need for folks to run over to their pens to mark that down on a piece of paper. What'll be available after the show, ami.ca/now blog. Hey, Audrienne, I know it's a couple weeks till the show gets on stage, but good luck through the rest of the practices and the preparation and the rehearsals. And I hope it goes really, really well.
Thank you so much, Dave, for having us, and we'll take all those good words.
That's Audrienne Bouchard, the producer, director, and writer of Camille, the Story. The Multisensory Theatre Experience starts Tuesday, June 21st at the Siegel Centre for Performing Arts in Montreal. Audrienne gave you a one website specifically for the show, but you can also find out more at siegelcentre.org, SEGALCENTRE.org, SiegelCenter.org. Shout out to my old neighborhood in Montreal. Coming up next in the Accessibility Story Roundup, I'll talk about how there's a limited industry for complex rehabilitation technology, otherwise known as things like motorized wheelchairs, and the impact that has on people with disabilities. But first, here is Canadian Press reporter Emily Javeski with your Morning Business Minute.
North American stock markets powered higher yesterday as strong U.S. economic data, including retail sales, showed that high inflation isn't restricting spending. Toronto's S&P TSX gained 285 points to close at 20,491. In New York, the Dow Jones added 431 points to hit 32,655. And the NASDAQ was up 322 points at 11,985. Our dollar is trading overseas this morning at 77.98 cents US. Statistics Canada will give its latest reading of how much the cost of living has risen when it releases inflation figures for April this morning. The agency's Consumer Price Index posted a year-over-year increase of 6.7% in March, the fastest pace since January 1991. From the Canadian Press Business Desk, I'm Emily Javeski.
Welcome back. It's Now with Dave Brown on AMI. We played a little switcheroo with the show clock today to keep you on your toes. So I've got the accessibility story roundup. Oh, this story coming to you from Mother Jones, written by Paul Roberts. It's called Two Behemoths Dominate the Motorized Wheelchair Industry and Disabled Customers Pay the Price. So there's an example here given about a very modern motorized power wheelchair. The Permobile F5 Corpus Motorized Wheelchair is outfitted with an elevator lift motor, two batteries, headlights, and a joystick. Brand new. Retails for $35,000. It's made by a company called New Motion, the manufacturer of the chair. However, the article shares a story of a customer who had one parts break, one teensy tiny part on the wheelchair. Now, without the wheelchair, the individual is immobile. Guess how long it took New Motion to replace and repair the chair? 80 days, 3 months. 3 months in bed for this customer as they waited for that $35,000 chair to have one part replaced. So complex rehabilitation technology is CRT. It's considered one of the broader terms utilized in this space. It's a multi-billion dollar industry in the United States. And over the last few decades, experts and advocates have been pointing to a decision by Medicare, the federal medical program in the U.S., to abandon set prices in favor of ones set by competitive bidding. So large companies with larger scale can undercut smaller companies. So what happens is the move reduces the federal government's costs by 35%, but at the same time, locally owned wheelchair shops quickly begin to disappear as large corporations consolidate the market due to lower prices that they can offer to Medicare and private insurers. So that allowed a few companies to buy up small competitors. So New Motion, who I mentioned before, as well as National Seating and Mobility, these two companies control about half the market of complex rehab tech. So if you are in the market for a motorized wheelchair or power wheelchair in the U.S., two companies control the market. And it just speaks to the way in which we're talking about technology and access to technology and how there's a few behemoths in the marketplace who do move towards some kinds of innovation, but are they serving the people who need the devices? It speaks to the interesting interconnection between service, technology, and disability, and how we certainly in Canada are asking for better assisted devices programs, whether it be at the provincial or federal level. But we need to remember that just because we're creating a quantitative need and filling a quantitative need, you can't lose the qualitative side as well. Just a thought for you on a Wednesday morning. Let's bring in Sam Robinson for the Entertainment Report. Sam, you have some news about a popular television show, Yellowstone.
That's right. Yeah, so anybody who's been watching Yellowstone can find it on Amazon Prime in Canada, as well, Paramount Plus in the U.S., but that's neither here nor there. This is one of the series that I've been meaning to get into forever because it's just been critically acclaimed, personally acclaimed by other family and friends, and I've been wanting to get into it because of the main sort of creative force behind it is director Tyler Sheridan, who directed a sort of trio of really impressive films, including Sicario.
You're leaving out the one that I loved the most, which was Hell or High Water,
right?
About economic inequality and bank robberies in the southern U.S. Like, so incredible.
It was a really excellent series, and Tyler Sheridan basically said that series itself was based on stories about the American frontier. So it really made sense for him to move to this project of Yellowstone, which basically follows the Dutton family, one of the largest landowners in Montana.
Wyoming?
Yeah, Montana. Yeah, and what we're basically coming out with a bit of news here is that there's all these prequels that it's so popular that they've already got prequels in the works. The first one came out called 1883 just this last winter with Sam Elliott, Faith Hill, and Tim McGraw.
Oh, I love Sam Elliott.
Two like country singers who are making acting big acting debuts, probably not debuts in my opinion, but there's another one coming out called 1932. And basically what we have is the two stars who have currently signed onto it, Helen Mirren and Harrison Ford.
Whoa.
Now talk about two big heavy hitters for acting. And also I really like that Harrison Ford is being sort of He's the one who's chosen for this role because he actually owns a very large ranch out in Wyoming.
Oh.
And that's like his big deal is he's a rancher. He's
a ranch guy.
Well, once you finish doing Han Solo, I guess, there's only one place to go.
Which is a ranch?
Yeah, or straight on Earth. Don't go off into space.
I don't think I'm built to be a rancher. I don't think ranching works for me.
It's a hard lifestyle. I can imagine. Like
I feel like the animals would know I wouldn't know what I'm doing. They'd revolt. They'd rebel. Next thing you know, I'd be in a pen.
You poor guy. Yeah. I mean, it is way more like livestock handling than agriculture.
I suppose. But like, if you told me I've got to remember to milk all the cows every morning. I'd forget.
Or bring the cows in.
Oh, bring the cows in. Rustle? You think I can rustle? I'm not a rustler.
Lasso them?
Chickens. I think I could own chickens. Like fresh eggs? Yeah. Like, let's rock and roll.
I'm not sure if you can own them in city limits, but for sure, give it a shot.
I'm sure my condo has rules about chickens. I do have a little green space in my backyard, but I'm pretty sure that would violate the condo
rules. You might
rules.
Become the largest landowner on this side of Overly.
I used to have this professor when I was in CEGEP in Montreal who lived in Vermont and lived on a farm and used to bring eggs across the border every morning and sell them to other professors at the school, which is like a big no-no.
Yeah, right.
But the fresh eggs, man. Marianopolis College.
What are they going to do? It's only going to be a crime if they catch you.
These eggs are for personal use.
Yeah. You didn't know. He might have hard-boiled them all.
Sam, I kind of wandered off the pathway there.
But
prequels for Yellowstone, so you and I are going to eventually watch Yellowstone, and then we can watch the prequels.
We'll be on it, Dave.
We'll be all over it. You've also got a Lindsay Lohan story.
Yeah, and it's a surprising one, too.
Or Lindsay Lohan, for those who missed Nizreen's What's Trending a couple of weeks ago.
We won't poo-poo her too much, but because it's a hard one.
The point of the What's Trending was that forever we've known Lindsay Lohan as Lindsay Lohan.
Yeah, right.
And it turns out, no, you should have been calling me Lindsay Lohan.
That poor woman. Because she has had a hard go of it, just like a lot of other female celebrities who were young child actors, in and out of rehab, and had a really hard go of things. Not doing a lot of film and television for a long period of time, and then just more in the tabloids than in the entertainment rags. And that has been changing for the last couple of years. Most notably, she's been at first in a Super Bowl ad for Planet Fitness. She's had a couple of different shows come out where she's been starring in. There's a new series of three Netflix films that she is going to be starring in. As well, there's a wacky concept for a reality show that she is not starring in, but narrating to a certain degree.
Okay.
Now get this. This is a strange one, even for a reality television show. Basically, you take a bunch of British teenagers around the age of about 21. Young adults, 21 years old. Take them over to the U.S., pretend that they're going to an American high school.
Okay.
And this is about their search for love.
Wait, what?
Again, yeah. See? So they are pretending to go to high school, but it's British kids.
I'm hoping they're sending them to meet like 18-year-olds, because otherwise there'd be some, ethical complications here.
It doesn't look like it's Pulitzer Prize winning sort of material here.
That's a fair point.
But it is to show that, she has been building on her sort of aughts fame, all of the Generation Z who might have grown up, or millennials who might have grown up with her as a bit of an icon.
More millennial star than a Gen Z star.
Yeah. It's kind of trying to bank on a bit of that nostalgia. Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. I mean, good honor, because mostly what we're finding from the other slate of female actresses like Britney Spears
Amanda Bynes.
Paris Hilton, Amanda Bynes, who got out of her conservatorship mm-hmm, as well recently, mm-hmm. It's showing that, perhaps the way that media and the society at large was covering these women who were young, vulnerable, and in really sort of trying situations.
It was cruel. It was mean-spirited.
They did some pretty terrible stuff to them, mm-hmm. and glad to see her back on her feet.
Yeah, rock and roll. Way to go, Lindsay Lohan. Sam, thank you for this.
Cheers,
Dave. That's Sam Robinson at the entertainment desk. By the way, I'm not judging the concept of this reality show. I watch a lot of trash. Floribama Shore. Oh, man. It's my kind of program. Let's bring in Andrika Dilanerol. She's going to tell you what's trending. Mm-hmm. So, Andrika, you've got an awareness day, but you've also got a day that's, a trial that's captivating the headlines. But let's start with the important awareness day.
Yeah, well, it's, you know, the thing is, the common thread here is that there are two events that took place yesterday that are still trending today at very high on the list on Twitter. So still today at number one is hashtag IDAHOBIT2022. And what that means is International Day Against Homophobia, Biphobia, and Transphobia. It's a very important day. It's recognizing the human rights of the LGBTQ plus community. And it's all about raising awareness about the continuous violence and discrimination that these communities are experiencing, but also communities such as diverse sexual people who have diverse sexual orientations, gender identities, or expressions. Mm-hmm. And it's a very important day. I actually found out an interesting fact about this, that this the date, which was May 17th yesterday, was chosen to commemorate the World Health Organization's decision back in 1990, so about 32 years ago, to declassify homosexuality as a mental disorder. So it's a very important day. It's recognized across the world in more than 130 countries. Mm-hmm. Including where 37 countries still say that same-sex acts are illegal. So it's a very important day. I mean, here in North America, like even in Canada, you know, it may be legal and people have the right to marry and all that, but to this day, all around the country, people are still facing social discrimination in different settings, at work, in public. And it's a terrible thing. And so that's why, you know, these days exist to really help just raise awareness and get people exposed.
In the case of same-sex marriage, it's only something that has existed in a legal framework for a little over a decade in the U.S., mm-hmm. a little more than a decade in Canada. It's something to remember, especially as we're having these conversations around legal frameworks of women's rights in the United States, that just mm-hmm. because we have the progress on the books doesn't mean the progress is going to stay on the books. So that's why I think a day like yesterday, where the trend began, is continuing to trend today, speaks to the way in which mm-hmm. we understand that fighting for rights is something that cannot simply be taken for granted because we've established a victory or hit a critical mm-hmm. point in progress. The progress needs to keep moving forward or else someone's going to try to bring it backward. Andrika, you've also got a story here, and I confess that I watch and consume a lot of nonsense in my life. The Amber Heard Johnny Depp divorce mm-hmm. trial is one that I've not put much bandwidth into. That said, goodness gracious, is it everywhere in the way that it's covered on social?
Everywhere. It is everywhere. Like, even if you're not actively following it, it's going to follow you. Like, you can't really avoid it. This case, like, the reason why it was trending yesterday was because the case resumed after a short break. Of course, it's the defamation trial, as you said.
I said divorce and Sam corrected me in my ear. It's defamation. My apologies.
Defamation trial. And of course, just quick context here. It has to do with that 2018 op-ed that Amber Heard wrote about. At the time when she wrote it, she didn't disclose the name, but she wrote about her experiences surviving domestic and sexual abuse. And of course, you know, her ex-husband, Johnny Depp, it was around that time frame. So he's suing her for $50 million, and she's counter-suing him for $50 million. Now, this is a complex, interesting case. There's so many things. Sometimes I question, why is this part of the case? I can't get into it all because really there is so much detail here.
There's a lot of just horrible behavior by alleged horrible behavior by two.
Yeah,
human beings.
On both sides. And soon by the end of the month on May 27th, there are going to be closing arguments. And what's interesting here is that the jury will decide both outcomes of the suit and the countersuit mm-hmm. at the same time. So in a few weeks, we should be, or not even a few weeks, is that
like 10 days, like 9 days?
Next Friday, we're going to know.
Those will be closing arguments. So there could still be some deliberation. Yeah.
True. And it's just really interesting here because we were talking about that social media aspect. You can't really escape it. But I don't know about you. It feels like, I feel like the general public, everyone's taking sides. I mean, I don't
even
know.
Which is weird.
so weird. And I don't know if you heard this story. It was about a week or something ago. There was a couple of Starbucks in America that had like a tipping jar at their drive-thrus. And you would tip for like Amber or you would tip for Depp.
So distasteful.
It's very weird. It's getting to be very terrible. I mean, this is a case about abuse on both sides. And, you know, also the fact that it's like televised and stuff, it makes no sense to me.
Yeah.
It's a very disturbing situation. And every time I see a post come up, I get a little sick to my stomach. I'm just like, what are people doing taking sides on this? These are two people. These are human beings here. They're not, you know, this is not a movie or something, you know, but.
But they've made it a bit of a spectacle too. Like
I
would say
definitely.
They've made it a spectacle as well. Like my sympathy doesn't necessarily extend to them, but my sort of disdain, disgust for the way it's covered is the way in which it's become a little bit of a media circus. And I think it like speaks to the way that like we need to create conflict when it's like, maybe they could just like sort this out and let the jury figure it out. And maybe we don't need all these cameras in court and like a million reports. You know, I go through the Associated Press and Canadian Press and ABC Newswires every day, and there's like multiple stories available to me to play, and I choose to play none of them because honestly, Andrika, there's so many important things in the world and I just don't have the bandwidth for this.
Well, expect to see it trending on social media probably every day.
Yeah. Hey, Andrika.
Gotta talk about it once.
We got to get out of here, but have a great day and thank you for filling in for Nazreen.
Thank you.
That's Andrika Delanerel, senior producer of the show. Coming up next, Mike Ross will be here with the big business story of the day. We'll talk about how a slightly cooling housing market is causing a bit of buyer's remorse. This is Now with Dave Brown on AMI. Welcome back. It's Now with Dave Brown on AMI. Let's say hello once again to Mike Ross for the big business story of the day. Mike, the Canadian national pastime strikes again, talking about real estate.
Yeah. We're talking specifically here, though, about buyer's remorse. And in some cases, even some non-seller's remorse. Mm. So let me just first relay my personal situation on this, which was before Christmas of 2021, we had started looking at potentially selling and moving to a smaller place. And one of the reasons, one of the catalysts for that was the house two doors down from us sold at such an astounding price that we thought, you know, let's get into this. Let's do this now rather than waiting 5 years.
Opportunity's knocking.
Well, it was knocking. We didn't really answer the door, though. That's the problem.
Oh.
And when we finally started getting things going and the one place that we looked at, we put an offer in, didn't get accepted, the whole thing fell apart. And it was like, okay, well, let's keep looking. And by the time we had moved on from that first property, everything in our neighborhood started to freeze, right? No viewings, no open house bookings, nothing in the South Ajax area. So we sort of missed out on the opportunity because we didn't really move fast enough on that. On the other hand, you've got people who just jumped in and they didn't bother to check and see the temperature of the water. They just jumped in.
Mm-hmm.
And what's happening now is as housing prices are starting to drop, and it is shifting back towards a sort of center market or maybe even a buyer's market, there are people who have bought in the last few months and are realizing, man, did we ever overpay on this property? In some cases, they bought properties that need major, like significant work, upgrades, the damaged properties, where not only were you overpaying or now you realize you've overpaid for a property, but you've got to invest $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 more dollars on top of your buying price. People are starting to feel that. A 25.7% drop in the number of homes sold year over year for the last months of March and April. So anybody who jumped into it back in the fall when I had started looking at it, and kind of regretted not making that sale. Anybody who did buy, kind of feeling that pinch now.
Yeah. I'm
thinking, man, if we'd only waited a little bit longer. The problem was the number of people who looked at what they could get for their current property and then leverage that against their new property and potentially be mortgage free or at least lower their monthly payments. And now they see that they could have been even further ahead if they'd just waited a little bit longer. But so goes the volatility of the housing market, Dave. They've been telling us for years, interest rates will eventually go up. Housing prices will then start to drop. And that's exactly what has happened here.
Right. So, Mike, you reported the volume number there, 25% less homes sold, only a 3.8% drop year over year in prices. And we're still talking about historical highs. The national average in Canada, $778,000 for a home. And that includes condos as well. So like, it's kind of wild. I check the market every day because I'm always looking for value and I don't particularly love where I live. And let me tell you, one bedroom condos in downtown Toronto going for $800,000, or as you reported, or as you mentioned, the total teardown house, the tiny teardown house, which basically needs a full demolition for going for nearly $1 million in East York. It's pretty staggering stuff.
Go to Vancouver, right? Oh. I mean, I saw a property.
I mean,
in Vancouver,
please, can I?
Day.
Will you allow me? Will our boss let me?
I would love to. but here's the deal. There was a property I saw there the other day, which was a smallish detached home. But just looking at it from the outside, I mean, the front steps,
dilapidated
wooden steps and all broken down, like just wood is rotten. You're just looking over all the windows have to be done. You're talking about a new roof. Once you get inside, who knows what kind of damage you're looking at there.
You can't climb the stairs to get inside, but if you do indeed scale into the house, you will see the extra damage that's done.
$1.5 million for that property.
Oh my God.
It's insane.
Even when we talk about a small drop in the price, the affordability is still out of control. Hey, Mike, don't go too far because after the break, we're going to talk to you again for the big business story of the day. I'll have a couple national news stories to share with folks. In the meantime, if you want us to reach out to the show, please do. Drop us a line, feedback@ami.ca, feedback@ami.ca, or give us a ring ding, 1-866-509-4545. This is Now with Dave Brown on AMI. Welcome back. It's Now with Dave Brown on AMI Audio, AMI TV, AMI.ca, or perhaps you're listening on demand on the mighty AMI Audio Podcast Network. I'm Dave Brown. It's Wednesday, May the 18th, 2022. Coming up in the second hour of the show, we'll talk some politics with Craig Oliver. Lots going on between the Ontario election, the Conservative leaders as well. And a new study shows a number of websites are collecting email and password data before you even hit the submit button. Oh boy, Mike Agarbo of The App Show will share some of those findings with you. But I want to update, starting in the world of climate change, the United Nations chief has launched a 5-point plan to jumpstart broader use of renewable energies. Andy Field files this report.
UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres saying the global climate report shows the planet faces a catastrophe if nations don't stop using fossil fuel, and that there is an easy fix.
Renewable energy technologies such as wind and solar are readily available and in most cases cheaper than coal and other fossil fuels.
The report saying greenhouse gases, sea levels, ocean heat and acid broke record high levels last year. Andy Field, ABC News, Washington.
And then a Canadian-based story in regard to climate change. A report on the wildfire that destroyed the British Columbia village of Lytton concludes the disaster could not have been stopped, even with an area-wide emergency response. Alan Westhaver, a wildland urban fire consultant and co-author of the report, says there was nothing the firefighters could have done to prevent the spread once it started.
We need to focus on solving that problem, and the answer is in making homes and communities more resistant to being ignited so easily. That's not necessarily a difficult problem. We know the answers to that, and it's something that people can do on their own properties, but most importantly, they need to work with their neighbors so that whole neighborhoods become resistant.
Recommendations to control future risks include evacuation routes, mandatory mowing of tall grass in residential areas, and development changes that set minimum clearance between buildings. Alberta's premier made a trip to D.C. yesterday. Alberta Premier Jason Kenney is floating the idea of a new bilateral pipeline project to help both Canada and the U.S. in their goal to establish North American energy security. Kenney says he's heard a lot of support from members of the Senate Committee on Energy and Natural Resources.
There's a lot we can do to get additional supply here, but we're going to need certainty and an expression of support from the administration, as I think we heard from this committee today.
West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin says he's in favor of creating a new energy alliance between the two countries that could help establish the North American energy security.
I think the whole world's depending on this. And the North American alliance that we're talking about with all of our friends in Canada, it could be a tremendous, it could be tremendously helpful for the free world.
Premier Kenney also used his two-hour appearance before the committee to urge the U.S. government to back Canada's fight with Michigan over the cross-border Line 5 pipeline. Federal Natural Resources Minister Jonathan Wilkinson was also at the committee. He urged the senators to embrace the idea of a Canada-U.S. energy powerhouse that would include a bilateral alliance on critical minerals. And one more story to share with you here. A new report says digital technology has become so widespread at such a rapid pace that Canadians have little idea what information is being collected about them or how it's used. Emily Javesky takes a closer look.
The report by David Lyon, former director of the Surveillance Study Center at Queen's University, says regulations have not evolved quickly enough to keep up with the ever-changing technologies. It highlights a need for transparency in data collection and analysis, as well as new digital rights and means of ensuring justice for Canadians. It also argues that some, such as women, Black people, and Indigenous groups, are more exposed to surveillance than others. Emily Javesky, The Canadian Press.
And we'll explore an element of that conversation with Mike Agarbow in about 15 minutes in the Talking Tech segment. But for now, let's bring in Mike Ross for the regional news update.
Dave, we'll begin in British Columbia, and the RCMP say 17 people have been arrested for obstructing logging operations in an area known as Salisbury Creek, 50 kilometers north of Kaslow, B.C. The Mounties say officers enforced a court-ordered injunction yesterday that was granted to Cooper Creek Cedar Limited in 2019. Police say they notified protesters blocking the Salisbury Creek Forest Service Road that they were in breach of the injunction on April 25th, and officers returned twice more with warnings of arrest. They say 8 people were released yesterday on the condition they appear in court July 19th, while the remainder were taken to the detachment in Kaslow for processing. In the Prairies, a judge is to consider whether allegations Manitoba Premier Heather Stephenson violated conflict of interest laws merit further judicial review. Liberal leader Douglas Lamont said he will appear in court today to present his case that the premier broke the law when she failed to disclose more than $30 million in real estate sales. The premier has acknowledged she breached the Legislative Assembly and Executive Council Conflict of Interest Act by not declaring the disposal of 3 properties in 2016 and 2019. She has said it was an oversight. In Alberta, Premier Jason Kenney is to learn later today if he has enough support from his party to stay on as leader. The United Conservative Party plans to release the results of the mail-in balloting on Kenney's leadership review. It's been a contentious process, with Kenney facing open criticism from a number of his caucus members. If he gets majority support, even a slim majority, he says he will stay on as leader. Kenney says he will then expect his opponents to get behind him or face yet-to-be-named consequences. To Ontario, Progressive Conservative leader Doug Ford is heading to Hamilton today to meet with workers at Stelco. Ford tried to position his party as the labor-friendly option yesterday as he touted an endorsement from another construction union. His political rivals have accused him of only paying lip service to workers. Andrea Horvath, who's NDP, is traditionally worker-friendly, is going to east of Kingston and then to Ottawa today, and she'll be talking about her promised PharmaCare plan. Liberal leader Stephen Del Duca is staying in Toronto to make an announcement on affordability. Green Party leader Mike Schreiner is in Parry Sound, Muskoka, again today. And to the Atlantic region, the police officer who shot and killed an Indigenous woman during a wellness check in Edmundston, New Brunswick, says he doesn't know why the situation escalated so quickly. Edmundston Police Constable Jeremy Sun testified yesterday at the coroner's inquest into the death of Chantelle Moore, who was shot on the balcony outside her apartment on June 4th, 2020. Sun says Moore exited her apartment, pointing a knife in the air, and advanced toward him despite his demands that she drop the knife. He says the police only had one working taser, and on that night, the weapon was with another officer. And those are your top regional headlines going coast to coast across the country.
Mike, thank you for this. We appreciate it. We'll talk to you a little bit later, but for now, we'll bring in Jeff Ryman for a sports chat. Oh, we had some sound going there for old Jeffy, but let's just bring him in. Who needs the sounder when you can just have Jeffy? So, Jeff, we've got a couple of playoff series to preview here in the NHL and NBA world, but I see you having a little chat with host of the Neutral Zone, Brock Richardson, this morning about some news that came out of Phoenix, Arizona yesterday. The Phoenix Coyotes, or the Arizona Coyotes, not going to be allowed to put their logo on their new rink being built on the Arizona State University campus in Tempe. A little bit of a humiliation there for the Arizona Coyotes.
Yeah, I saw Brock Richardson post that or share it on Facebook. My comment was Bush League. Could you, like, 5,000 person capacity at a university arena, and they can't even have their own logo on it? Like, that is something you see in a beer league, or not even in a beer league. Like, this is like, this is pretty embarrassing, I think, for the NHL. Like, I don't know how Arizona is still in the desert. They have to relocate. How could you keep going like this? This is ridiculous, in my opinion. Like, come on.
I'm going to level with you, Jeff. I agree. It's definitely Bush League, or maybe Cactus League, if we're considering the geography of Arizona, a Cactus League situation down there. I am very interested in potentially going to one of these 5,000-person NHL games. I can heckle the players from super close.
But is that a good thing? Like, is this almost is so embarrassing that you have to go check it out? There's like sort of like a negative context behind this. It's like, this is ridiculous, but I gotta go check it out. It's almost like it almost reminds me of where it's like, remember a couple years back where the New Orleans Saints had their, or was it Denver Broncos had their wide receiver playing quarterback? Where it's just so ridiculous. You had to check it out.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is the same thing where it's just so ridiculous that it may actually draw people in, but still not a good way to sort of advertise and market your product in the NHL.
Tickets are like $20 to sit in the nosebleeds, but the nosebleeds like might as well be like lower bowl in other arenas across the league. That's not too bad. And you know, Phoenix is nice in the winter, and there's legal sports gambling and legal cannabis. Like, my parents live there in the winter. I can make a case for myself to take a little trip down to Phoenix. Tempe in this case.
I don't even know if there is an upper bowl, Dave. I think it's just one bowl.
It's a singular bowl.
Yeah.
I kind of like it. I'm going to go down and heckle some players. I think that'd be fun. I think that'll be a good time for me. You know, it's important to
enjoy. I might join you then.
There you go. Me and Jeffy on a road trip. I can't come with you and your friends to Vegas for your bachelor party, but I'll drag you down to Tempe for a little Arizona fun. Jeff, let's preview a couple playoff series here. Let's start with the Battle of Alberta. We've been teasing it for 2 days. Oh, we're going to talk about the Battle of Alberta. And then it's like, sorry, Alberta fans. We ran out of time. So let's actually start with the Battle of Alberta. Edmonton and Calgary locking horns for the first time since 1991.
Don't tell Daryl Sutter it's the Battle of Alberta. I don't know if you saw that soundbite.
No,
but
no.
He's not buying it. He's not buying the Battle of Alberta. But nonetheless, you know, us sports people, we're going to call it the Battle of Alberta.
We'll call it what we want, Mr. Sutter. Although he is kind of Alberta royalty, so maybe he does gets to be an authority on this.
I was thinking the same thing. I don't think I'd ever want to fight nor go against Daryl Sutter. So, you know, I'll relax on the Battle of Alberta. It's Calgary versus Edmonton. But Dave, I like it. We talked about the rivalry yesterday. But in terms of the on-ice product, I think this is going to be, I don't know if lopsided is the word, but I do think Calgary is the much better team in all three levels. You look at the goaltenders, Mike Smith for Edmonton. I will give him credit. He has actually had some pretty good games. His numbers look pretty good.
Shutout in game sustainable? Seven. Shutout in game seven.
Exactly. But is it sustainable as a 40-year-old going against one of the most powerful offenses in the entire NHL? I don't know, Dave. And then you look at the defense for Edmonton. Again, a little bit spotty on the back end. And same thing goes for their forwards. I think Calgary has them beaten all three levels. Jacob Markstrom, just a phenomenal, phenomenal goaltender. Dave, we've talked about Calgary's defense before. We don't really need to add much to that. In Calgary, they have the best line in hockey. I'm going to go out and say it. 40 goal scorers on the same line. You just don't see it. A couple guys over 100 points in Matthew Tkachuk and Johnny Gaudreau. So I'm sold on Calgary. I think that Dallas, well, more specifically Jake Oettinger, was one of the primary reasons why Calgary couldn't get going. I think we've just seen the tip of the iceberg from the Calgary Flames. I think that they win this one, not easily, but I'd say in five or six games.
Nobody in the league had more even strength points this year than Johnny Gaudreau of the Flames, which is something to note. I believe on even strength play, Calgary is going to have a significant advantage in this series. Here's my one question for you, Jeff, because the LA Kings threw two really high-end defensive centers at the Edmonton Oilers, that being Anze Kopitar and Phil Deneau, who were both really good in that series. I don't mean to diminish the overall style of play that Calgary plays, which is very responsible, defensively sound, possession-driven, and dominant in play. But I'm not sure they have the true defensive forwards to throw at players like Connor McDavid and Leon Draisaitl. I just don't think they have that high level of shutdown center. And you know I love the defensemen in Calgary. I love Noah Hanifin. I love Rasmus Anderson. I really enjoy the way Oscar Shillington moves the puck. But I'm not sure they have that beast who can really take Connor or Leon out of the game. So I agree with you. I think Calgary on paper is clearly the favorite to win this series, but I'm not sure they have the individual pieces to take over a player like Connor McDavid, who through game six and game seven of the LA series really showed why he is the best player in hockey.
Yeah, I think it's going to be more of a collective group effort from Calgary. I think it's a no-brainer that there are two guys on Edmonton that you really have to watch out for. And I think that Daryl Sutter is going to zone in on that and make it sort of a group effort to try to not take out those guys, but try to ease their chances just a little bit, because there's no stopping Leon Draisaitl or Connor McDavid. We've seen Connor McDavid literally dance around four or five guys, like the whole team, just by himself. That's just the skill level that Connor McDavid has. But if you can limit those guys just enough, and obviously, like I said, the offense on Calgary is pretty darn good. And you also have a pretty solid goaltender, like I said, in Jacob Markstrom back there. So it's definitely going to be a more of a group effort. And I don't know if there's many centers like Philip Deneau or Anze Kopitar, at least, you know, on the defensive side of things. So that was probably tough on them in the first round. And now they're going to get pretty much an entire Calgary team on them in the second round here.
Calgary better not plan on winning games 2-1 in this series. That's all I'm saying. Like, this is going to be 6-4, 5-4, 5-3 kind of games throughout the series. That's my estimation of it. I'm taking the over. Jeff, we don't have too much time here to talk about the Rangers and the Hurricanes, New York Rangers and Carolina Hurricanes, both teams coming off Game 7 victories. This is a bubble rematch from 2020 in a series that Carolina took rather handily from the Rangers. But this Rangers team is a little bit different.
Yeah, they are. We talked about how St. Louis could be a little bit sneaky. I mean, St. Louis took Colorado to overtime yesterday.
Good game last night.
Very good game. I think the New York Rangers are kind of that dark horse in the Eastern Conference. I'm still up in the air as who's going to win this. I mean, you look on paper and you look at the stats and the standings from the regular season, and Carolina was just off the charts. Especially defensively, they allowed only 202 goals throughout the entire season. I believe the next on that list is in the 220s. So their goaltending was phenomenal. Obviously, Freddie Anderson still out with an injury. Antti Raanta has looked pretty solid, but talk about forwards playing defense. You know, Carolina has a bunch of those guys, not to mention their actual defense is really good too. I think
former Ranger Tony D'Angelo revenge series.
Yeah. Oh, I can't wait to see what the boos are like at Madison Square Garden when they head there for games 3 and games 4. But Dave, yeah, this is going to be a closer battle, but I wouldn't sleep too hard on the Rangers here as well.
Okay, Jeff, I'm going to hold you to sort of one or two thoughts here on the basketball series that starts tonight between the Dallas Mavericks and the Golden State Warriors. Golden State holding almost every single discernible statistical advantage going into this series, but Dallas has our boy Luka Doncic.
Oh, my goodness. Luka Doncic and company. I mean, they held Devin Booker to and the entire Phoenix Suns to 24% shooting in the first half of Game 7. And that's basically all they needed to take out the powerhouse in the Phoenix Suns. I wouldn't put anything past them right now. Luka Doncic is right now probably the best player in the NBA.
Best player left in the playoffs is Luka Doncic.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And when you have the best player in basketball, you're giving yourself a really good shot at making a deep run. We've seen it before. LeBron James on those Cleveland Cavaliers team, he was the best player on the planet, had a decent supporting cast, but nothing ridiculous. He was able to carry Cleveland to a couple of championships. Maybe Luka Doncic does the same thing, Dave.
Luka Doncic, to this point in his playoff career, has played about 30 games. Only one player has averaged more points in their first 30 NBA playoff games than Luka Doncic. That player was named Michael Jordan. That's pretty elite company.
That is pretty elite. Although Golden State, no slouches either. I think I'm looking more forward to this series than the Eastern Conference series.
Oh, big
for
time,
sure.
Big time.
I mean, we talked about maybe the lack of star power in the East. This one's got a bunch of stars, bunch of Hall of Fame talent.
Yeah, just on
both sides.
Three titles, five finals appearances, like no big deal for Golden State. Just, you know, business as usual. Jeff, thank you for this, buddy. We'll talk to you again tomorrow.
See you tomorrow, Dave.
That's Jeff Ryman. He's at the AMI Sports Desk. Sam Robinson finds himself at the AMI Weather Desk.
Thanks, Dave. And here with your AMI National Weather Forecast from Environment Canada, we start off as we always do in Corner Brook, Newfoundland, where you've got a mix of sun and cloud this morning, 40% chance of showers late this afternoon, and the high, 16 degrees. Over to Charlottetown, PEI, a mix of sun and cloud, 30% chance of showers, and the temperature steady near 12 degrees. Moving over to St. John, New Brunswick, a mix of sun and cloud, clearing late this afternoon, the high 15 degrees. Up to Quebec City, it's clearing this morning, the high today 16 degrees. In Toronto, sunny this morning, increasing cloudiness near noon, then a chance of showers later this afternoon, the high 15 degrees. In Sault Ste. Marie this morning, sunny, becoming a mix of sun and cloud near noon, the high 16 degrees. Over to the prairies, in Brandon, Manitoba, cloudy with a 60% chance of thunderstorms, then a mix of sun and cloud, the high 15 degrees. In Regina, it's cloudy, a mix of sun and cloud this afternoon, the high 16 degrees. Over to Lethbridge, Alberta, a mix of sun and cloud this morning, the high 18 degrees today. Over to Red Deer, a mix of sun and cloud, 30% chance of showers late this afternoon, with risk of a thunderstorm included, the high 14 degrees. Up to the territories, and in Whitehorse, it's mainly sunny, the high 13 degrees. Over to Kelowna, mainly cloudy this morning, periods of rain ending near noon, and the high 16 degrees. And finally, in Vancouver, rain ending near noon, then cloudy with 60% chance of showers today, the high 11 degrees. And that was your AMI National Weather Report from Environment Canada.
Thank you very much, Sam. Coming up next, a new study shows an overwhelming number of websites are collecting email and password data before you even hit the submit button. Mike Agarbo of The App Show will let you know about those findings. But first, Google is back in the tablet game. Here's Jim Ryan with Tech Trends.
Android Authority C. Scott Brown says one of the biggest surprises from last week's Google Developer Conference was a Pixel tablet planned for 2023.
He actually said at one point that we are out of the tablet business. And this was only like maybe 2 years ago, I think, maybe 2 or 3 years ago. So it was like really surprising to just be like, oh yeah, guess what? We're back to tablets now.
The company didn't reveal many details about the new device outside of the basic design. But Brown says it's what'll be on the inside that counts.
It's going to have to make Android a terrific competitor to Apple's iPad software. And if Google can't do that, then Google's own product is going to fail.
But as for the immediate future,
it's going to take a while for Google to find its footing. So I don't think Apple has anything to worry about. I think that Android tablets are going to continue to be a niche product that, you know, only specific Android users are really going to care about.
With Tech Trends, I'm Jim Ryan, ABC News.
Welcome back. It's Now with Dave Brown on AMI Audio and AMI TV. Let's talk tech with Mike Agarbo. Mike is the host of The App Show, which you can find Saturdays at 11 a.m. Eastern Time on AMI Audio. Hey, good morning, Mike.
Good morning.
So, Mike, we've got a new study by the European researchers showing an overwhelming number of websites are collecting email and password data before folks are even hitting the submit button. Mike, who are some of these websites who are taking our stuff?
Well, they didn't name them specifically, but they checked this out in Europe and also the U.S. In the U.S., close to 3,000 major websites were collecting this info, and in Europe, just over 1,800. And what they're collecting is information from forms, even if you didn't submit those forms, hit the submit button. So if you're filling in your name, address, and email, maybe even password to set up an account, it would actually take all that information, even though you didn't really hit that button to give it to them.
Mike, not to jump too far into the coding minutia here, but how are they doing that exactly?
Well, they found that most of them, didn't know that they were actually doing that. But a lot of these websites use third-party marketing and analytics plugins for their websites and forms. And through those services, that's where it was essentially happening.
Is there something we can do as users to prevent websites from taking that information from us?
No, not too much.
Oh, great.
Your information is gone. It's gone, gone, gone. But, you know, they did alert a lot of these websites to the fact that this was happening. And so, you know, many of them were trying to make changes to make sure that they weren't taking this info that we weren't readily giving them.
Mike, let's jump over to the world of streaming, where Netflix has updated its company culture guidelines to include a, quote, artistic expression section. What does this mean exactly?
It's interesting. You know, they've had some issues over the past year with some of their content, some of their employees not agreeing with it. Most recently, the Dave Chappelle comedy special, some people felt that he made transphobic comments during his comedy that they didn't agree with. Netflix is essentially saying now to their entire team, and quote, not everyone will like or agree with everything on our service. Obviously Netflix, they have such a wide variety of content on there. So they're essentially saying, if you don't like it, you can leave Netflix.
Yeah, which is what some employees did. Some employees left the company after some of those controversies last fall. Has there been any reaction from employees since this update?
No, I haven't heard anything. You know, obviously Netflix is going through some challenging times right now. You know, we talked about how they, lost subscribers for the first time in 10 years, during the last quarter. I think in the past week here, they've actually, laid off 150 employees as well to, cut some costs. So, no news yet as to whether this is going to cause any more employees to leave.
Mike, you and I have talked a couple times on this show about the shortage of semiconductor chips, which have been impacted for a whole number of reasons. We'd be here all day if we listed them all. But there's a company in the UK that is proposing something that is akin to electronic dumpster diving. The Royal Society of Chemistry has proposed the idea of mining e-waste to feed consumer demand. So what are they considering e-waste?
Well, e-waste would be literally anything electronic, anything with a computer board inside of it. And, you know, as we know, you know, these electronics that we have, they don't have a long lifespan. You know, typically smartphones and computers, you know, only last for several years, maybe computers, you know, 5 to 7 years before we send them to the big bin in the sky. But, you know, the challenge is, you know, even like the laptop that I'm doing this Skype call on right now, there's 30 or at least 30 rare earth minerals that are used in the manufacture of this. And those are hard to actually find and refine as well. A lot of times these rare earth minerals, they actually occur, you know, near each other, but there's also radioactive elements that occur with them that they have to extract during the, you know, the manufacturing process. So, you know, as you can imagine, that's, you know, difficult to do and also toxic and, you know, difficult to deal with as well. So by looking at the e-waste that we have, you know, trying to find a way to get those minerals out of the motherboards and the circuit boards might be a better way to help supply our future chip needs.
You know, you had that nice sort of mamby-pamby hugging of the trees here. I agree with you. But how lucrative might this be? Let's talk about the quiche.
I don't know, like, you know, what is the cost of actually, you know, getting all this e-waste and taking it to a facility that can actually get it off the motherboards? I imagine it probably wouldn't be more than having to go into the actual earth and dig it up and refine it. And that's what they're saying. Like, all these rare earth metals that are on the existing motherboards that we have now, they wouldn't have to re-refine it. It's already refined. So I think there would be some cost savings there. But, you know, it has to be set up in a proper way so that all the manufacturers of the laptops, the phones, microwaves, anything with a computer board in it have a, you know, an effective recycling program. Right now, they say it's only about 20% effective. And so as you can imagine, it would have to go up dramatically from there to be viable.
Well, Mike, if you find me lurking around the dumpster behind Best Buy, you'll know why.
You're looking for those rare earth minerals.
Oh, you know me, Mike. Always mining. Hey, Mike, have a great day. We'll talk to you next week.
Thank you.
That's Mike Agarbo. He's the host of The App Show. You can find it Saturdays at 11 a.m. Eastern Time on AMI Audio. Coming up next, we'll talk politics with Craig Oliver. Got a little bit of news brewing around the Premier of Alberta, so we'll touch on that with Craig. This is Now with Dave Brown on AMI. Welcome back. It's Now with Dave Brown on AMI. Sometimes a political story sneaks up on us. A couple of weeks ago, the mail-in ballots went out to UCP members across Alberta, asking them whether they wanted to put Premier Jason Kenney under a leadership review. Turns out we're going to find out the results on that today. Sometimes you report the story and then it vanishes into thin air and comes back. So let's bring in Craig Oliver to talk a little bit of politics. Craig is a veteran political correspondent and joins us from Ottawa. Hey, Craig, this one snuck up on us a teensy tiny bit, but we're going to know a lot today about the future of the Premier of Alberta, Jason Kenney.
Yeah, Dave. However, the fact is that however income, whatever the outcome, rather, for the Premier, it's not going to matter. The melodrama, the viciousness of the internal struggle going on within the Alberta United Conservative Party is not going to stop. And also charges of voter fraud. The RCMP are still investigating that charge from the past. And Kenny's already murmuring that a lot of people that nobody ever heard of have suddenly been signed on. The suggestion being they signed on as conservatives by people who wanted Kenny out. Mm. And here's why really this matters. Kenny has said, and I think this is extraordinary, but that if he doesn't, as long as he gets 50%, he's staying on.
Mm-hmm.
And there will be a war within the party if he gets less than 50% and stays on and doesn't. But if he stays on, but if he doesn't stay on with more than 50%, If he decides that's he can survive it, that will be viciousness you've never seen before politically.
Yeah,
go ahead.
In a statement, he actually said, if he gets more than 50%, for those who do not get behind him after that, there will be unnamed consequences.
But the fact is, the bottom line has always been more like 60% for a leader to go to the party members and say, do you want me to stay or not? I think we think of Klein, who got 55% from the party and said, that's not enough for any mm-hmm, leader. Mm-hmm. And there have been many cases like Joe Clark, you won't remember, but I do, quit the party, and he had 68%. So you need a lot more than 50% to stay on.
Yeah.
That doesn't give you any credibility as a leader. And so that's Jason Kenney's problem right now. But we'll have an answer pretty soon.
Yeah, Craig, we oftentimes talk about some of the fractures that exist at the federal level inside the Conservative Party, but there's a much more recent history inside Alberta of a fracture. In fact, that's the reason why it's called the United Conservative Party of Alberta, because it was only about 10 years ago they had the fracture between what was a Conservative dynasty and the Wild Rose Party that ended up leading to the NDP winning an election.
Yeah, and I think that if he decides to stay on with only 50%, the party will split again, for sure.
Yeah.
And so we'll be through all, as I say, the melodrama doesn't stop. And this is important stuff politically, the relationship between Alberta and the federal government, decisions involving international energy have never been quite so important as they are right now. There's a lot riding on the outcome of this vote this afternoon.
Yeah, yesterday talking to a Senate committee in the U.S., today facing a party leadership review. Things can change quickly in the world of politics.
They do.
Craig, let's pivot over to the visit that the royals are making across Canada this week. Prince Charles has begun his visit to Canada with a stop in Newfoundland and Labrador. Let's hear some opening remarks where Prince Charles reflected on the challenge of climate change and reconciliation.
However, as we look to our collective future, as one people sharing one planet, we must find new ways to come to terms with the darker and more difficult aspects of the past, acknowledging, reconciling, and striving to do better. It is a process that starts with listening.
Craig, as per usual, there is some fanfare and attention being paid to this royal visit. But on the flip side, do you think there's an appetite amongst the people, amongst the mass populace, to sever or change the Canadian relationship with the monarchy?
Has indicated that a bare majority of Canadians would like to see us move on, drop the colonial concept of having a foreigner as our head of state. That's where the what most people would expect would be an outcome. But I think what is clear here is it would be inconceivable that we would go ahead with an effort to get rid of the monarchy with all of the significance that has. We can't do it without a national vote, without a referendum. So that would be what would happen first. And then this is why I think this is all so unlikely. Say Canadians vote, and by a very large margin, we've just been through this with Kenny, most people would say over 60%. If they get that, then the next question is, what do the people in the provinces say? Because this comes under Article 41 of the Constitution. You've got to change the Constitution, remember. We are a monarchy. And so we'd have to wait around to see what the outcome would be in terms of the vote by the provinces. So, and the vote by the provinces has to be all in. Even one province that doesn't agree could then prevent an ouster of the royal family happening. So that is unlikely. And then even within each parliament, each of the provincial parliaments would have to agree. So this becomes extremely difficult. And I'm not sure we're ready for that. It's easy to say, let's get rid of that tired idea of being a monarchy. It's easy to say that.
Yeah.
But doing it is extremely difficult. And I don't think right now very likely possible.
Yeah, talking about the what is easy. Discussing the how requires constitutional lawyers and billable hours, and I don't think that's in our budget, Craig. I've got one more clip I want to play from you of the Prince of Wales, because he did have some glowing words to say about Canada's place in the world. Oh, hold on one second.
Time and again, you have shown your country to be a safe haven to those in need, a respected leader on the world stage, a much-needed voice in advocating for a greener and more sustainable future. And in an era where the global institutions of democracy look distressingly fragile, a model of determination and humanity.
So, Craig, Prince Charles is indeed the heir to the throne, and Queen Elizabeth is getting older. Does this perhaps feel a tad like a PR trip, maybe trying to improve his profile in Canada a tad amidst the conversation we just had?
I think that's absolutely true. And I think I admire him for this because he knows what he's going to be facing. He's going to face questions about whether or not the British government should issue an apology, whether the crown itself should issue an apology, because remember, ever since, I think it was 1783, when the British sent envoys all over Canada in canoes to sign treaties, those treaties still stand today, every word of them. So there is a suggestion that the Crown knew, must have known, the kind of things that were going on with the residential schools and didn't deal with it. And so there will be talk of what kind of recompense is needed to resolve all of this, if that's where this goes. In the meantime, we simply don't know, and the Prince Charles himself doesn't know. Mm. And one of the problems is the fact that Charles is not really as much of a star in terms of the globe, in terms especially of Canadians, as his mother has been. And there's even a joke in Britain, people saying, can't we just skip this guy and go on to William? Right? That's impossible, of course, but that's even the feeling of many people in Great Britain.
Craig, in the 17th century, that would start a war. We got to be careful with talk like that, skipping over generations in the royal lines like that. Hey, let's jump over to Ontario, where we have the Ontario election. We're now officially at the halfway point. The Progressive Conservatives still holding the lead they had at the start of the campaign. Craig, it feels like this campaign has just been really quiet. Not a lot of movement here.
I think that's right. And I think in this last really strong poll, not poll, the debate,
yeah.
It was a really useful, deep debate. I mean, we saw a lot there. The premier survived it. He wasn't a star. He kept looking at notes he had and left us wondering whose notes are these? Are they his or are they his staff telling him what to say? He still has this lack of credibility on the part of many people, and I don't know what kind of a role that might play in the election. So I think the worrisome part about this for the Conservatives isn't that they might win. It's what if they win and they can't form a majority government again?
Mm.
Both the NDP and the Liberals have said they will not support a Conservative minority. So this is a big deal now. You come to this thing in a big way or you go home. Mm. I mean, there's a big problem there. And I don't know what Ford can do about that. Remember that he had an extraordinary 40% last time. He can't possibly have those kind of numbers again. But he does have a 13-seat lead, and that will help him. But this is his problem now.
Craig, I had a chance to moderate a debate last night in the Brantford area in Ontario at the W. Ross MacDonald School for the Blind, and the Conservatives didn't bother to send a candidate to the debate. And that's something we've seen from a couple debates across the province, local debates, where candidates are not showing up. They're keeping a really tight message and keeping a low profile. Why is that strategy proving to be so beneficial for the party?
Well, it has been so far. That's right, because their approach has been, if you don't say anything, if everything you do say is written and negotiated within the party, if all of that happens, then you can't get in any trouble. And don't even let our MP, our MPPs say anything controversial or anything that is out of the tune that the leader is singing. Stay in there, stay with the hymn book. Don't foul anything up, and you can't go wrong. You you can probably win for sure. And that's why they, if they could, they would avoid debates, but they can't. And that's why the only chance people had to really see where the premier is going, and he got a pretty rough time from some very strong politicians.
Yeah.
Especially the surprise was Michael Schreiner, the leader of the Green Party, who I think was so strong, powerful words directly to the premier. Have you ever thought about nurses who you claim you've done so much for? Have you thought about how you froze their salaries? Have you thought about, have you ever talked to any of them? It was really quite damaging to the premier, but I think he tried to come back, but he was shaken by that for the only time, I think, in the whole debate.
Craig, I think it's fair to say that Mike Schreiner is one of the people who political pundits thought of as the winner on Monday. How far do you think his reach is with the Green Party?
Maybe. I mean, they have one seat now, I think, his. It might bring him another two seats or something. But, I mean, there's no chance. It's not in the books anywhere, that kind of a win. So I think we're still... the other two,
Andrea Horvath and Stephen Del Duca.
Let's say Horvath first. This is her fourth time at bat. If Canadians in Ontario weren't going to elect her in the last four elections, why would they do it this time? Mm-hmm. That's the question people are asking. And she did seem a little bit off balance sometime during the debate. As for the Liberal, he was sharp. He's really what we used to call a bit of a policy wonk, but I think he was reduced. The Liberal Party was reduced to seven seats. Hard to see them coming back to win a government. But there is this question of whether or not the premier can get himself a majority again. Mm-hmm. That's the issue now.
Right. How much sniping between the Liberals and NDP may actually result in some vote splitting in areas like the Greater Toronto Area and the Ottawa Area that could result in another majority for the Progressive Conservative government, even if they only get, say, 34, 35, 36% of the votes.
Correct.
Yeah, it's a really interesting... It's such an interesting component of our electoral system, the way we see
that
story play out.
Well, the other thing that's going on here is we have a battle for who is the opposition leader, not who is the premier,
between
the Liberals and the NDP. On the side of their election, that one is going on.
Hey, Craig, we're going to run out of time here, but I do want to get a quick thought from you here on some politics around language that are brewing in Quebec. Stop me if you've heard that before, Craig. A language storm brewing in Quebec.
I have.
The provincial government is set to pass Bill 96, which would significantly restrict access to English services in the province. Areas like the courts and access to health care would be impacted. The Office de la Langue Française and its enforcement arm would also be given new powers under the bill. Anglophones, Indigenous people, and allophones have all expressed concerns. Craig, I'm an Anglophone from Quebec who made the choice to flee over 10 years ago and leave the province. So you can pick my brain a bit here as we move forward. But from your experience covering politics, just how thorny can language politics in Quebec get? And how much do federal politicians typically want to stay the heck out of it?
They can, but they can't. They can't stay out of it. And that will be inevitably what happens. And I want to hear you on this one. My experience with all of these Quebec issues going back a long time has been from the view of the federal government, because that's who I've always. The problem is they can't stay out of it. So it's going to drag them down. And my experience is whenever a separatist provincial government, and that's what we have really, he formed a party which was supposed to be a coalition, but really whenever they did that, it was to start the movement again for sovereignty and for a separatist agenda and eventually for another referendum. That's where they were always going whenever they introduced something like this. They know the kind of trouble this is going to cause.
Yeah. To me, Craig, there's...
And so tell us how much it is.
Yeah, there's always going to be ebbs and flows in the way that Anglophone rights are talked about in Quebec in the presence of the French language. And for a long time, Craig, I'd say pretty much from the referendum in 1995 through to just a couple of years ago, there was something of a détente. There was a realization amongst Anglophones, you better get on track and learn to be French and learn to speak French and be bilingual. That's beneficial to you both from your position in Quebec, but also from a more worldly perspective. Part of that culture is good for the province. And there was also a realization amongst the Francophone community that being more inclusive and welcoming to English was good for business. It was good for the province. It brought in a lot of economic opportunities, but it was also good for young people in the province if they chose to go somewhere else. But as you say, there's something brambling here inside the Legault government about cultural values, about the presence of French and Francophone culture that's becoming, I'd almost call it culturally protectionist, that is starting to look away from some of the benefits of the multiculturalism and bilingualism, the détente that was reached for about 20 years, and maybe taking us back to some of the politics of René Lévesque or Lucien Bouchard or Jacques Parizeau.
I just want to say this. In the last 20 years, English-speaking Canada has changed dramatically. Mm-hmm. It's more confident. It's more sure of itself. I don't think it's ready for a long debate about what separatism would mean. And the idea of referendum doesn't frighten people the way it once did. Mm-hmm. Let me just say that.
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, Craig, we are officially out of time, but we'll talk about the Conservative leadership race next week and for many, 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 many weeks up until the fall. So you for now have a wonderful day, and we'll talk to you next week.
And you, Dave.
That's Craig Oliver. He's a veteran political correspondent who joins us from Ottawa, Ontario. Coming up after the break, we will talk to Ramya Amuthan. She is the co-host of Kelly & Company, and she's going to let you know what's coming up on the show today. This is Now with Dave Brown on AMI. Welcome back. It's Now with Dave Brown on AMI. Let's look ahead to this afternoon when Kelly & Company hits the airwaves at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on AMI Audio. Ramya Amuthan is the co-host of that show and joins us now with a preview. Hey, good morning, Ramya.
Good morning, Dave.
So, Ramya, I was off to Brantford last night to moderate that debate, so I missed the show yesterday. Okay. And I'm going to download the podcast, I promise. But give me the TLDR, the too long didn't read, or in this case, the TLDL, too long didn't listen, on when I should be throwing out my walking shoes with Francis Wong.
Okay. I'm so glad. You're so good at following up with these things, Dave. So basically, the smelly thing we didn't really touch on, but if you find holes in your shoes, or like a really cool tip, I'll just say this, is if you take a shoe that has not been worn and then compare it to a shoe that you have been wearing like for a month plus, she said that you can tell with the heel, like how worn in the heel is, you know, how flat that padding is.
Yeah.
Yes, the foam. And that's a really good way to check, you know, just realistically. And then the other thing is, oh, I don't remember the exact number, but it's a certain amount of miles / kilometers that you should be taking your shoes on a walk for. And usually that's around 6 months. And then after that, you should be looking for new shoes.
All right. Okay. So not just the smell test. There's actual statistics and numbers to work on this. That's good. That's
positive.
Ramya, what's coming up on the show today?
We're talking about the U.S. television network still because they've wrapped up their spring cleaning and there's many, 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 many cancellations, says Greg David. He's going to give us the details on that. Yeah. Mark Miller, we're going to meet him. He's a piano teacher who specializes in teaching blind and partially sighted students around the world. He has a special technique and he's going to tell us about that, or his teaching style, I should say. Mary Mammoliti of Kitchen Confession is joining us about... And we're chatting about eating fresh this spring. So, you know, eating seasonally, what that looks like in Ontario for produce that you can find in season at the time.
Can't wait for berry season. We're still a little ways away from berry season, but I'm looking forward to berry season. Ramya, we've got 30 seconds here, but you're musical. Do you play piano?
A little bit. Only enough to sing with, Dave. Okay. Not enough to be like, I'm a whiz on the piano.
One of my big regrets in life is my mom made me take piano lessons when I was young, and I was too ignorant and silly and stubborn to be like, this is really good, this is really cool. I should have just learned to play piano properly, because now I'd say it's my favorite instrument, and I wish I knew how to play.
Wow, that's how I feel about French.
As an adult, I'm like, I should have taken more French.
Ooh, yeah, you're talking to a former Montrealer here, so I have some regrets on that one as well. Hey, Ramya, thank you for this. Have a wonderful show today. Thank you for hanging around a little later for us today.
Thanks, Dave.
That's Ramya Amuthan, the co-host of Kelly & Company. I'm Dave Brown, the host of Now with Dave Brown. That's right, we named the show before we hired me. We'll be back again tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. Eastern time. Until then, play safe, play fair, but don't forget to have some fun.
This was an AMI podcast. For more accessible media, visit AMI.ca.